When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Okay, motherfucker!
What are you looking at, sir?
I'm looking at you, miss.
Run that, baby.
I'm not the Zodiac. And if I was, I certainly wouldn't tell you.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to One Heat Minute Productions special decade project, where we're going back through this year, the films of 2013. And I have decided to enlist the originals. All right, let's put the fucking band back together if you're going to go all the way back to 2013 to talk about one film, probably, I would argue, like one of the last great and truly original Marvel films. Let's firstly introduce a man who prodded and poked and instigated in the best possible way this series, a Twitter scamp, someone who makes me laugh, but I can never ever like any of his responses to any tweets because it would get me in so much trouble. It's Stu Coote, everybody. Here he is back on the show.
It's a pleasure to be here. I just like keeping people honest.
Yeah, yes, you do. You absolutely do. And internet trailblazer, the only movie newsman online that is actually still doing it with integrity. It's Garth Franklin, everyone. Dark Horizon's own. How are you, sir?
Not too bad. I prodded and poked in a completely different way.
Yeah. We just glossed over the prodding and poking that has happened between us over this time. So, lads, I got you in. You guys are kind of doing a double feature, double act on two episodes back-to-back of the Decade Project. I decided to start with the much more mainstream, affectionately named Kiss Kiss Clang Clang by the lovely Jon Favreau. It is Iron Man 3 from Shane Black, written by Drew Pearce and Shane Black.
I'm Tony Stark. I build neat stuff. I got a great girl. And occasionally save the world. So why can't I sleep?
You elected me on a single platform. I will defend this country at all costs. The Mandarin must be stopped.
You don't know who I am. See me coming.
What are you going to do about these attacks?
The whole world's going to be watching.
The question, where is Tony Stark?
Things are different now. I have to protect the one thing that I can't live without. That's you.
Mr. Stark.
Today is the first day what's left of your life.
Go!
I'm gonna offer the choice. Do you want an empty life or a meaningful death?
You're not a man. You're nothing more than a maniac.
I'm not afraid of you. No politics here.
Just good old-fashioned revenge.
We do need backup.
That's your department.
Thank you.
right in the pocket of Marvel Phase 2 when there wasn't 27 phases of this thing, when we were still absolutely and utterly thrilled about these flicks. And it's one that's had probably was probably unfairly maligned at the time because it just, you know, it was so different. It was not necessarily in step with where the rest of the series was going. And this was a funny phase because it was like big swings that were really super successful. Like you had Captain America, the Winter Soldier, and then ones that were pretty trashy, even though they've kind of been resurrected by things like Endgame, like Thor, the Dark World. But we had Iron Man 3. This was such a fun time to be a Marvel fan and such a fun time to be a superhero fan at this time because we also had Guardians coming up. But Iron Man 3, 2013, made a squillion bucks as these movies have wanted to do. But man, I was so happy going back to it because I truly feel like this is when every one of these new movies that they gave to someone really felt like it had the stones to be its own thing.
Yeah, and it felt like the last time. One of the biggest things I hate about the MCU now is the introduction of the nanotech, where we just touch our temple and we put on whatever costume we need. This feels like one of those last times that there was actual, like, I know it's all VFX for the most part anyway, but it actually felt like he had moving parts in the suit, and the suit had a certain weight and a heft to it when he moved. Like, it felt like he was still a guy in it, not in a just doing the sound, just doing the voice work, like jumping to the heads up display. And when he would bump into things, it actually felt like he had the suit on, which was nice. And it felt a lot more grounded compared to sort of where we are now, which is a bit alarming.
Yeah, traveling along.
And Iron Man 3 is the grounded version.
But that disassembly of the costume is key to the whole plot. That's the whole thing, is all that parts that come, you know, split apart and come back together and all kind of thing. That's a huge part of the whole appeal of this story.
And I love also that, like,
but you're right.
The nanotech as well, like, as you said, Stu, sorry, Garth, we'll jump back into you in just a second, but it's that whole, like, the actual, not body horror, but it's like the body modification aspect of it, like stamping these little sensors through his entire body and putting band-aids on and, like, you know, I'm putting these nano, you know, remotes in my body to call different aspects of the suit to different parts of my body. I mean, we didn't get to see him inject anything into his junk, but we can only make the assumption. But
well,
it just...
that's the classy thing to do.
And
From a storytelling point of view as well, there's something about the slowing the sort of action down to put for the suit to go on. It just gives everything a moment to pause. I think one of the problems in sort of, as you're saying, you're jumping 10 years and we're coming to modern day and sort of looking at the two. When we start going through portals and people just popping up out of nowhere and striking, we never just slow down and actually focus on the action the way we should. It was funny rewatching Avatar and watching when the ship is chasing the jet is chasing the dragon for the first time.
Yes.
And it's all relatively slow. The Cameron's like just getting right in, and you're sort of, it just grinds everything down and laser focus on these movements, and they're not zipping by at 1,000 miles. And I think that's what these modern things are missing. Like, everything just zips on and we're jumping and we're going and we're, instead of actually, like, boom, let's suit up, let's have a bit of weight to this, let's do something. It was just interesting how many times in this it actually just paused to actually make that suit come onto him. And it just makes you focus in on every little moving cog and wheel. And I miss that.
Well, this is before that time of, like, so many supporting characters and so much interlinking with the cinematic universe. And, you know, you had that, there's that window between the rough early phase one stuff where it's all, you know, the Edward Norton Hulk and all that kind of stuff, where it's a little, oh, this is not quite working that well. And that period probably from about 2015, 2016, when they just started becoming so interconnected, like a TV show, it just doesn't work. You know, there's just so many chefs to cater for at different, you know, catering different points. So it's losing that sort of time where you can spend just focusing on the process of stuff and focusing on the consequences of different things. It's not.
And
I'm by
no means a Shane Black acolyte. I think there's a
oh, I am.
I am.
Yeah, exactly. There's a there's a fairly vocal thing of people that, like, he can do absolutely no wrong. And I think...
Oh, no, he can do wrong. No, he can do wrong.
This Predator. This feels like, he can do wrong.
But this feels like... watching this feels almost like playing Shane Black bingo. You're like, oh, let me guess. He sets it at Christmas and he's got a wisecracking like kid and he's got the henchman with like the witty wordplay. And it's like, it somehow still works in this. I'm like, I think he's, yeah, mate, I'm high on things like Night Guys, but I'm lower on
this. This is one of the last ones.
Bang, bang.
Well, this is one of the last ones where you had an auteur in charge doing a Marvel film that gets to do his own thing. Where it's not completely smothered by the formula. And so that whole, there's the implication that the twist that they had with the Mandarin in this thing was so upset the fan base, like the hardcore Marvel types, that Feige kind of came in and said, all right, you know, we're going to be much more vetting of things now. We're going to be much more sort of locked down on things before we start. And so a lot of those individual filmmakers have come along since then, your Chloe Zhao's, your, you know, the two who did Little Miss Sunshine, that did Captain Marvel, that kind of stuff. It feels like they're restrained, that you don't get to hear their voice anywhere near as much. The only two that have sort of really escaped that in the later phases were Gunn and Cogler.
But they had the runs on the board from taking the swings.
And also, I think
they sort of had the characters, they were kind of separate from the thing, so they could do their own whatever they want.
I was just going to say the hierarchy of the characters, because it was funny at the time, you know, that the top three characters that they had, or sorry, top four, were like Hulk, Thor, Iron Man, Captain America. And kind of once they had those, it felt like, oh, okay, we've got to lock these down to be very specific things. And then when Guardians was introduced, it was like, oh, what the hell? Like, we don't even know if this is going to work. And they basically were like, let's do it. And then it was such a bombastic smash and so refreshing that, you know, that was all of it, all a thing of its own. And then Black Panther, it was almost like, we don't really know what to do here. And so they just kind of trusted Coogler after the incredible success of his still completely underrated Creed. Which is absolutely sensational. And so you kind of have those things, but it is a bit Shane Black bingo. I do get that. And if you're not an acolyte, I totally understand it as well. But like, this is the last time that in a movie in this series that Tony Stark's like, you know what keeps going through my head? Where's my sandwich? Like, the last time that it was like biting, funny, like just like silly. Even with the henchmen, like how far away is Oklahoma? And he says it. And he goes, "I'm good." Like,
oh yeah, the ponytail guy was like,
"Yeah." 10 out of 10.
Other line that I absolutely loved is when they're in the final scene when him and Rhodey are behind the wall, and he goes, "I'll have a look," and he looks, and he goes, "What'd you see?" He goes, "I was too quick. Like I didn't see you." And there are those that like it works. I think like I love Shane Black's writing. I just don't think it's like. I mean, I'm out there on the front line of the Nice Guys every single day banging the drum, as we all are. But I don't think he can do absolutely no wrong. But there are times in this where I think this might be RDJ's best work for the franchise.
Oh, yeah,
like,
the PTSD aspect
of it. He gets to be Tony Stark, actually. He gets to be Tony Stark. But he does the panic attack thing, which you don't really see in American movies.
The panic attack PTSD aspect of it is... so amazing. Like it's actually it grounded those stakes so well. And I think that even though people didn't like Thor the Dark World, like when Winter Soldier came out pretty quick succession with this, it was like, oh, these might be the two best Marvel movies. I think if people were doing their lists, Winter Soldier would probably be pretty high on a lot of people's lists. I know it's certainly on mine. And at this period, and I'm just like, this is actually good. Like all that bombastic and splash and all that sort of stuff, it does have human consequences and there's a human toll. And with Tony, it's himself, like that scene where he's having a nightmare and Pepper grabs his shoulder and the freaking suit comes in and grabs her and pulls him away. It's like, there's some kind of like dark elements to this in like a not trite way. Like it actually really works. And it's fun and it's silly. And I totally have all the time in the world for this. Whereas like some of these new movies that are coming out, I'm just like, no, I'm good. Like I'm fine. And then like eventually now I'm like Kate, my nearly 5-year old son, scarily, nearly 5-year old son is just like, Dad, can we watch this? And that's usually the barometer. I'm like, yeah, man, cool, we can check it out.
Yeah.
He's like, wait, there's a Spider-Man. There's more than Into the Spider-Verse. I'm like, yeah, it's quite a few Spider-Man movies actually. Too.
And you're going to go on to see many, many more.
Yeah. I'm like, let's,
but it
let's...
also does the smart, it does the smart thing as well of like, and I think most superhero films are at their strongest when you rip the superpower away from the hero.
Yes.
You actually sort of like you, and this is the problem where we've just got like bulletproof, and it's my issues with sort of the John Wick franchises. They keep going. There are zero stakes. And this felt like when he's going around without anything and he's having to like scramble.
Oh, and he's
on
breaking
the run.
Into the Miami Mansion sort of thing with just the glove and the.
And when he's come from the bar fight and there's all that sort of stuff, I was like, this is what you need. You need a degree of vulnerability to make it work. And this is sort of pre, like I say, there's a lot of VFX here and there's a lot of old school sort of green screen. But wasn't it awesome just to see? It wasn't that long ago we could shoot the hell out of a bar.
Yes.
We could go into it all, like we could go into like a Midwestern bar with like a drunk sheriff and everyone there. And I'm like, someone said on Twitter the other day, like, well, I can't remember who it was, where they're like, every film from the 80s looks like so much better than anything today. And like, even now we're getting the nostalgia.
I want to quote that tweet because it's from one of my favorite all-time follows. You must follow him. You can find him at J Frankensteiner. So it's John Frankensteiner rather than John Frankenheimer on Twitter. And it says, it's crazy how the most disposable movie from the 80s has cinematography that goes harder than most things being produced today. You'll stumble on a piece of shit starring the two Coreys and the night scenes will look like a fucking Michael Mann movie. And I'm like, that's my guy, dude. That's my fucking guy.
By no means, because at the time we were saying these things are as disposable as Guardians 3 now, and we were saying at the time it was gaudy and it's ugly and it's not the thing, like there's still the hamburgers that we still shouldn't be eating and definitely 10 years later shouldn't be going back to, but just compared to that sort of washed out golden purple look that the MCU has sort of clung to now, and especially in the latest Ant-Man, they've that like the quantum realm has those. And Guardians, to an extent, just have those washed out purples. All the vibrancy's gone. I was like, there are so many sets that look real. This looks like you're in an office. You're actually in a bar. You're actually in a house. Like, which feels nowadays, they're like, could you tell we filmed this all in the volume? And you're like, yes.
Yes, I can. Yes.
Yeah. Funnily enough, I believe it.
Like, even as destroyed
that's when visually the only probably really weakest parts of the film is like the bit where his house gets destroyed. Because there's so much CG smoke in there. Yeah. And that's the one part where it's like, this just doesn't look that great. Whereas so much of the night scenes in the snow and everything, on the other hand, like,
when he's carrying the physical prop of the empty Iron Man suit in the snow, I remember that in the trailer. And then you see it there. It's
the
like,
action.
Oh.
I've got to give him full props on the action. The bit where he's flying around the room with just the glove and the boots. It's obviously him and a wire, but it's actually being done. And you know, the same with the whole thing with the Air Force One, the big skydive scene.
Yes.
It's like, they're really CG'd an Iron Man to the scene, sort of like, probably on top of an actual skydiver, but there's people actually doing some group skydiving shit. There's people getting dumped into the water and some of them
And
that scene rules so hard because like in Superman movies, they've done versions of that scene. Even Superman Returns has a pretty terrific one that's similar to that where like Superman flies up, saves Lois in a plane, etc. But like that scene, I remember watching that and being like, I was like, man, this kind of rule, like it kind of has Point Break vibes. I'm like, this is awesome. Like,
works because you have it's good with the use of the music. It's not overbearing on the scene. It just let it go. There's a lot of just actual sky noise and lots of stuff. It has a whole concept of your barrel of monkeys thing. And it just builds and builds. And then you have Paul Bettany doing the countdown and all that kind of stuff. And it's all like, it just flows.
Yeah.
But then finish it on the button, to finish it on the gag of the truck. Like that's the perfect, it's actually the perfect edit point to be like, I didn't see the truck coming. And because you're like, what the hell? Like it looks great. I mean, I thought Guy Pearce is he's the type of person you want in these things coming in to swing for the fences for the 2 hours.
10 out of 10.
Becky Hall is great fun, even though probably underutilized for what, like.
The character was completely redone. Yeah, yeah.
Well, yeah, I think I'm so glad I've got Garth on this show because he can tell us. But also, can we pour one out for just how fucking good Ben Kingsley is as the Mandarin. Like,
yeah, I'll get even further than that. The whole Miami sequence, I mean, where he gets into the mansion. How many Marvel movies can you have there's none other like this, where you have one of the heroes walking through essentially a mansion full of,
like, a late night.
There's like coked out hookers and. That girl's
I'm going to get her on the show. She's outstanding. If I wanted a guest to talk about Iron Man 3, I want to talk to that girl. Bikini clad gun finger girl from the scene in the Miami mansion and the ponytail guy are my two number one draft picks for this kind of chat.
Yeah. That's the old Matt Gawley show, the I Was There Too podcast.
Yeah.
Where he went around finding the biggest extras the smallest extras in the biggest scenes. And that'd be perfect for that.
Matt Gawley, if you're listening, we loved your show, James Bonding. Matt Gawley, if you're listening, find the finger gun chick. She rules.
But even just him, like Kingsley coming out of the toilet going, I wouldn't go in there for a while. And just such a great twist on it. Like, I think that's, and what a way to shove it up the sort of Asian stereotypes of like the 60s and 70s of the comics anyway, of like all the angry neckbeards at home going, we want our racist Mandarin. Give us where's his like Fu Manchu moustache? And where's his where's all the Asian iconography? I just thought it's such a smart way to play with it. And they lost, I don't know, maybe they've lost that like sort of self-aware.
Yeah, they got enough from that. That's they're not going to do that kind of bold thing again. It was a real swing for the fences for them. That was, and it was actually, it plays in the theater when you're watching it in the cinema. I remember people like laughing their heads off when the sort of the big Kingsley reveal sort of thing happening.
Yeah,
but you can tell there's obviously some group of people who are just like fuming.
Hashtag not my Mandarin.
Yeah,
exactly.
But
and if it paved the way to get Tony Leung, then so be it.
But that's the way it goes. You know, it's like the same thing happened with, Starship Troopers, where you go in a room and see that in the cinema audience, and some people actually are in on the joke, and the other people think it's like a straight face, and you're like, what?
But this still felt when they were like, these were silly. These were meant to be,
It's still a comic. It's still a comic book, guys.
And this
the scene with the cameraman in the truck, the Italian stock bay thing, and all that kind of stuff. It's like, it's pure comedy.
And even the goofiness of like the president being in like the Iron Patriot suit. I was like, that looks straight out, like that shot looks like it's straight out of a corny 60s, 70s comic book. Like that looks like in 20 pages, we saved the president and we saved that the scale of that seems like it was perfect for sort of Iron Man, which they've kind of gone away from now. Like we didn't really have, I love that we spent about 0.3 of a second on like Guy Pearce's like backstory. Now that has to be stretched out to be like, here's your hour long arc that you're not actually the villain. Where I like that this is like, you know what? I'm the villain.
And he's selfish and greedy and that's what he is. Yeah. Like it's all about the money.
And it's all right to have Lex Luthor. It's all like they don't need to be a jaded person from the hero's past that, from a certain point of view, they're actually
or, the good or like guy. A brother or something like that.
Yeah. just like comics, like you're the dark hats, you're the light hats, and just go. I think there was I don't really think we've benefited in the last, in this 10-year period. We've had some notable villains, but these felt like we're on a different track there at that time.
Garth, can you give Stu and I and the people listening a bit of the skinny on the rework? Because I know that you would have absolutely sort of heard how the script was reworked. But you talked about Becky Hall, who is phenomenal, an absolutely phenomenal actor and filmmaker. She's getting better and better. Like, she was at this kind of weird nexus period where she was like living out of a bag and staying in hotels and like bouncing from things like The Town into Iron Man 3 and Vicky Cristina Barcelona. And she was like bouncing around these films.
The Gift is great.
Yeah, she's bouncing around all these different films. And then she gets, now she's making films, which is even more awesome. But can you give us a bit?
Passing was great.
Can you give us a? Yeah, Passing was terrific.
Can
you give us a bit of a skinny on that?
Not a lot to give. The one thing that was very well known was that Rebecca Hall was supposed to be the real Mandarin. That she was going to be revealed as sort of the big thing
the big bad,
as opposed to like working for PSU is going to be sort of the big one controlling it all. And then they kind of cut back her character. How much, the question is how much was shot and how much was actually in the script. That's where the line, I'm not sure where that happened, where it was, they changed around that sort of thing. But it got really reworked. It really feels like
that, that turn could have been fucking amazing, right? Like it could have been like that. She's the big bad who's orchestrated all of this to get to trap Tony, a former relationship. I mean, it sounds great. And obviously the fact that it's Pierce, it's cool, but yeah, no, I really love that.
It has the feeling of like that there's, cause it's a three act thing. So everything before the snowy Colorado, whatever area. And then, Tennessee. That's what it was. And then all the stuff in the ship docks and the post Air Force One, everything sort of in between then is the real sort of Shane Black stuff.
Yes.
And that's the stuff that felt like it's been, you know, pretty locked from the beginning. Whereas the first act and that third act feel like stuff that got reworked quite a bit.
Yes. I do love though, and I couldn't get it out of my head, especially after recently being a teacher, the line, I consider myself a teacher. Like I watched it again, and the monologue is, some people call me a terrorist, I consider myself a teacher. America, ready for another lesson? Like, man, the lines.
He does the old Panto voice for like the actor.
And that intercutting and Kingsley just chewing everyone's face off in every scene that he's in this movie. I'm like, this fucking rules. Like, this is a great idea. It's a great conceit. And it's even funnier just how damn convincing it is in that. And also, if you're looking at it from a, like a real character perspective, you can tell how like this very seemingly obvious thing by the time you get to it has been orchestrated, or it seems like it's blown up, because you've got a guy who's mentally, psychologically compromised for the whole first part of the film. Like it's saying the smartest guy in the world can't see through the iconography, can't see through this kind of weird amalgam of different, Orientalist thoughts, and fears and fear mongering from that time. He can't see through it to see that it's a charade, right until the point that there's nexus.
There's a line early on where he says, there's a lot of pageantry going on here, a lot of sort of thing. He knows something's up, but he can't figure out.
He can't put his finger on it. Yeah, you're spot on, but he can't put his finger on it because he's compromised. And I even love that scene where the little boy goes, like, asks him the question in the bar at the beginning when he's there with Rhodey. And he runs out to the suit to check that he's...
When they're trying to get his autograph. And he's like, the two kids. Well, that's the other thing. Because, I mean, this was only, what was it? Maybe the second or third film with Don Cheadle.
Second film. Yeah.
Because we're going to be talking about Prisoners next. And it's just interesting to see that what they lose with the actual changing out for bringing Cheadle in. I mean... I always think it'd be interesting to see if they never made the change, what it would have looked like if Terrence Howard had a stay. But I thought, like,
he's a great actor.
Don Cheadle's great as an action. You sort of think, it's annoying we didn't get enough. Like, we didn't get more of him in that period of some more action. the one thing I think is still good, and this people will hate hearing this, I still think Gwyneth Paltrow is really good in these.
She's
like,
good
for what she has to do. She is. For what she has to do, like. She's actually she's not given much to do, but when she's on screen, she's putting in. She's putting in the work.
This is pre-Goop Gwyneth. And I also think
it is.
And I also think what's hilarious is anytime that Gwyneth talks about being in these movies, there's an amazing episode of The Chef Show. So if you're a fan of Jon Favreau and the movie Chef, which I utterly adore, one of my favorite American indies. Maybe one of my favorite movies that he's ever done, or things he's ever done in his life. Terrific movie. There's a great episode on The Chef Show with he and Roy Choi where Gwyneth's talking about the fact that she forgot she was in the first Spider-Man movie. Like, she just completely forgot that she was actually even in there. I'm like, that's when I like Gwyneth, when she's forgotten she's even in a Marvel movie. She probably got $1 million and forgot. Like, it's good stuff.
And also, she probably turns up and... for the amount of post-production work and for what she's walking around on, like, the green screen set, those old, like, because back when you'd see those behind-the-scenes things and it's just the tiered, like, literally green oblongs everywhere. And she's like, then, like, 18 months later gets the email saying, do you want to come to Iron Man 3 premiere? No, I'm good. Sorry, I've got stuff on. I was like, was I in this one? Like, was I in there? Like, who's the female lead from Sopranos who was just in Avatar 2?
Edie Falco.
Yeah, where she thought Avatar 2 tanked and never came out after she
that's
filmed
it. Right. Yeah, that's right. Because she showed it like 3 years.
Yeah, and she's like, I just thought it fell over or died on the vine and we never heard anything. Then it comes out. She's like, oh, yeah, I was also in that. And it's, I think,
That happens with these movies. They had this, I remember they interviewed the kid in this, Ty Sheridan. And so he pops up in Endgame in the funeral scene.
Yes, he
and
does.
And apparently he shot that 18 months before it actually got released. And so he couldn't say anything for like nearly 2 years because it was like, he was told, oh, you're going to be in this thing. Just pop in for a day and come back. Bang, there you are.
Well, or even Chadwick Boseman used to like be quite proud of the fact he's like, these aren't the movies I watch. I'm not into, I don't watch superhero movies. I'm out watching my friends in it. Like, I'm consuming my art that I want to consume. I think we all get so riled up because for us on the outside is always looking in. We're like, how would you not want to walk around and like be with Tony and ask Jon Favreau about stuff? And you go, oh, that's right, because their perspective is completely different. But what's interesting in the 10 years that's happened, we didn't have Disney Plus.
No.
Like that's come, like streaming has come along. I sort of to have, I've got this on DVD upstairs, but I was like, oh, just watch it on Disney Plus. Favreau's gone on to be one of like the major players, obviously at Lucasfilm now and everything else. And we've gone from strength to strength from this. Mm. RDJ's gone up and is now sort of plateau.
He's doing what he wants. He can basically has enough money to say, just do whatever he wants.
He's made out like a bandit in this, within this 10-year period. And even when was Endgame? That was 3 years ago now? Is it three?
Four. Coming up to four.
So it really in that 6-year window is that where RDJ went quite like scaled those heights very quickly and then made the cash and got out. And it's fascinating to see what's happened in that time. And I think, maybe with Guardians that Marvel sort of slightly corrected or we'll see what happens with with Kang the Conqueror to see if they've got a phase 5 or not. There may be the writer's strike maybe have halted the phase 5 rewrite that's probably required at the moment. But it is interesting to see how big this has actually gotten. And I don't think even then we would have predicted that the TV show, like that was always the pipe dream, right? That they'd be like, and you'll have the interconnecting TV shows that you have to watch.
Well, I think that's the thing. They did at that time. They started having, they had like S.H.I.E.L.D.
Did they have the Netflix?
Just started. No, that hadn't started yet. So I think S.H.I.E.L.D. had just started. And Agent Carter, which was actually surprisingly good, that one, had just started. But they were... But all the TV shows before them were never connected to the movies. They were like, you hear in the TVs, you had mentions of the movies, like events in the movies.
Yeah.
But there was maybe one or two characters came and guest starred, but there was never any crossover back.
It was like the girl from Thor who we see in a flashback fighting something was thing. In one episode of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. You know, like only one that carried over was Coulson. And I maybe watched two episodes of that show. I don't even really remember it personally. And then Agent Carter was one that like, it wasn't really on Australian TV. Like you couldn't really get it.
They didn't know what to do with it.
They didn't know what to do with it. And
you know, it was a weird period kind of mystery thing, but it actually had good comedy in it.
Yeah.
And that was something you didn't really get, that sort of stuff. DC was struggling in the movies. It actually was doing very well on television with that whole Arrow, Flash, whatever thing.
Yeah, the Arrowverse.
Whereas Marvel was doing strong in the movies, and then TV was just not doing very well. You had that and golden period of like Daredevil and Jessica Jones in their first seasons were very strong first season. But then
this was at least satisfying not to be blue beam in the sky for its finale as well.
Yeah.
Like just have it was a fairly grounded, like all of the first three Iron Man films are all like that. I mean, who's he fight? He fights Whiplash, and then fight for.
Where is my board?
This is not my board. And then the first one, he's obviously fighting Jeff Bridges, like he fights the Warmonger. Then the second one, they're fighting all the suits, like the knockoff suits from the Hammer one. And then this, it's a fairly, it is that sort of small scale skirmish that I think it'd be nice to go back to. And it's not just.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the others were sort of an inverse of the hero's powers. At least this feels somewhat fresh with the sort of, I mean, the logic of when people do and don't blow up when they're Warren G regulating. I'm not too sure.
The trouble is everything after this sort of had, it was either that wormhole in the sky, world ending, big thing like that, or it was a fight like Black Panther, with a fight on a really bad CG. It was just this like, over the top visual effects
even,
kind of thing.
Even Black Panther, which is probably, you know, I would totally understand people saying the best Marvel movie ever. Some people could say is Black Panther, and I would hear that argument and probably agree. Like that, it's. But even Black Panther has a fucking ghastly end fight. The end fight stinks up the whole movie. Like the bar fight in the actual body of the movie. Rules and
yes, it's an actual bar fight.
It's a bar fight, and then the end with the train and the suits and the bouncing around that all stinks. And then, fortunately, Coogler can immediately resurrect the terrible scene by having like this emotional, you know, philosophical quandary conversation of Killmonger and Chadwick in death, like that, you know, as he's passing, and then like has that phenomenal ending where like Wakanda comes to America or into the ghetto to like actually make its presence known in the world, which is so cool and so moving and terrific. Like that movie top to bottom is spectacular, but those
scenes feel like on the script is like, then superhero stuff happens and then I take back over, like, the AD comes in and shoots.
It infects everything. That's why, I mean, WandaVision had the same thing. It was started out such a good series, and then it ended in a big sky fight / wormhole, whatever. And the one that escaped it, funnily enough, and it was probably one of the best ones in the recent years, was Loki, which the entire season finale was Jonathan Majors and the two Loki actors sitting in a room talking. That was it.
Yeah.
There was just three actors in a room. And
Jonathan Majors, he was really good at getting his words to like wrap around someone's throat and pin them to the wall. I noticed in that. Like, it was. Sorry. Too soon. Allegedly. Too soon.
Can we take him anywhere anymore, Garth? We can't take him anywhere.
10 years and I'm still making those gags.
Oh, gosh.
Allegedly.
I'm in a right turn into. Can I just say, if your cast has James Badge Dale, William Sadler, Dale Dickey as Mrs. Davis, Miguel Ferrer, I'm in. Like, I'm just actually 150% in. Like, it is just a pure 80s schlock cast. All the best.
Bill Sadler and Miguel Ferrer as a president, vice president. It's like,
It's like
Miguel Ferrer has never told a lie on screen in his life. He's only told
lies on screen.
Yeah, it's so good. Like, he just, that's exactly what he is. He's the vice president. Bang.
Like, and what's even more hilarious, it's like the last movie that I remember Miguel Ferrer in and loving him as much is Hot Shots Part 2. Like, it's and that's a movie where he's blatantly honest in every line, and it's just played for absolute stunning hilarity, and it's just fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, you crank Iron Man 3 two or three degrees to the left, and you're in Hot Shots as well.
you're right there on the line, but like, great choice of supporting cast, like as far as like top tier AAA, AAA class actors, and then we get right down to the E's. You know what I mean? It's like, it's like the E plus legends who, like, you see their face, you're like, I fucking love this guy. Like Miguel Ferrer has been in
the who's who of that movie.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Like, I think that's another thing, the MCU is missing a little bit. Like we sort of, I mean, I feel like what someone like Redford was doing, for instance, in Winter Soldier. Like they were, again, they were leaning into it. They knew exactly what they were. And we sort of got to go back and mine some of those. Like it's like the old British theater actors, what they bring to it. Like they can just come in, hit it every single time. I have a ball going back to this. I was just watching it going, I was having an argument with someone the other day about what's better, like Rogue Nation or Fallout. And he was like well and truly in the Fallout camp and just rolling him through like this sequence is in like Rogue Nation. This is this. And he's like, that like, cause it, like he was blurring four and
blurring
five
the
together.
Lines.
And he's like, oh, that's right. Like I just, and he's like, concedes like the eight things he loves. He's like, yeah, but it's still Fallout for me. I'm like, no, it's not, not that easy with like Iron Man 3. He's like, oh, that's here and that's here. And like again, the party house sequence at the end, they're all bangers. Like,
I think in Iron Man 3, and this is my memory, I was trying to think back to like what I thought about it at the time. And I remembered that Iron Man, the first Iron Man, obviously is a spectacular superhero movie. It is just pure personality from both Favreau and Downey, and it's just killer. Wall to wall is absolutely just charming the pants off you completely. It's sensational. And then Iron Man 2 came along, and it then suffered under the burden that some of the later movies did, where like, you know, at the time it felt so like it was hinging on building to this Avengers movie. And at that stage, it was an unknown quantity. We didn't know what we're going to get out of Avengers. Was it going to be good? Was it going to stink up the place? Like we had no idea. Like we were going with these movies, like we'd seen the Incredible Hulk. And I don't know about you guys, but I'm so much more a fan of Ang Lee's Hulk than the Incredible Hulk. I thought the Incredible Hulk stunk. I really loved
Ang Lee's Hulk has Sam Elliott saying mutant French poodle in that. It's like that wins me.
10 out of 10, right? 10 out of 10. So you got that. Then you had Iron Man, terrific. You had Thor, which is super fun. Like very, you know, took a lot.
Thor is just like Kenneth Brenner doing just big old British pantomime, Dutch angles.
The Dutch angles. Great. I was just going to say,
he's got old, Dutch like angles. Space opera. You don't get that much.
It's good stuff. Captain America, the first Avenger, which I think is...
It's just Joe Johnson doing Rocketeer again.
It works. It's so wholesome and just great.
It's so earnest.
And great. Sensational. And then you get Iron Man 2, and I feel like a lot of the stuff that was leveled about the concept of these was like, oh, if they're building to this big thing called the Avengers, is it just going to be all this like, hey, you had to go see these other movies to enjoy the movie that you're currently watching? And that's the trap that Macquarie always talks about attempting to not do when he's making mission movies, which is like, I don't want you to be thinking about another movie when you're watching my movie. I want you to be thinking about the movie you're watching.
They're not homework, which have just felt like utter homework. And they're the most depressing scene, I think, and this was the same case back then. Everyone was saying this, but the fact now you all I still hang out for the post-credit, like, stinger.
Yeah,
I'm outside a methadone clinic, like, just going. and I'm always thinking, like, it's probably going to be shit. Like, but what if it's Wolverine? Yeah. And I'm like, I fucking hate myself every single time I sit there going, if I just get a guy that a claw comes out of his hand, I'm back. And I go, I fucking hate myself every single time. And every single time they suck because they haven't done a post-credit singer now for, I don't know, for 8 years that's actually meant anything. And we've ever seen
they've all been like
the follow through now. They're just like, someone comes on the screen now and just goes, beep, beep, beep. And I go, oh, great. Now I've got to go fucking Google Marvu. Beep, beep, beep. And I'm like, oh, yeah. Not going to turn up in there. I'm like, great. And I've now just incurred $4 parking fee because I went past like 3.5 hours at Westfield. So great. Just for the shitty thing I could have Googled.
Funny enough, that's why the only sort of Phase 4 film I've actually liked was Shang-Chi, because that was standalone.
Yeah,
there was nothing. It didn't really link to any of the others. It was just, yeah, that's then you'd be its own little sort of old fashioned kind of Jackie Chan fantasy kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's its own like Marvel Wuxia sort of thing. Like,
So, but when you think back to Iron Man 2, the big burden was like, man, this is just trying to be this interconnected thing. And then I think by the time.
But it's also the character. Did you notice that with Iron Man 2? It's like Tony Stark is a very tricky character because he can be a very abrasive.
Yes.
Very condescending, and that can come off as like a real prick if you don't handle it too well. That's the whole thing. Downey has such charisma, he can do it pretty much well in his sleep. But there was something with that film. That was the one film in the three that it felt off.
Yeah.
It felt mean.
Yeah.
Like Iron Man 2 feels mean. It just feels like Whiplash is mean for the sake of because you stole my father's arc react. Like everything just feels like nasty. We see him getting.
Yeah,
I mean, the Formula One stuff's fun. There's Sam Rockwell's always good as that.
But Sam Rockwell's the star of that movie. He's so much more fun than Tony Stark.
Yeah,
he's so much more fun.
And
it just feels like it's a burden. He finds the shield, and everyone's just like, "Oh, it's just like spot the other movie that you don't want to be watching." And it was just like boring as batshit. And then, so when Iron Man 3 came around, it really felt like, at the time, an incredible return to form. So, like, we saw the Avengers, which was great. It's like, can these guys go back to their own segment, their own apartment in the build, in the growing, you know, in the growing compound that is Marvel movies, and still throw their great party that has its own feeling and its own mood and its own tone? And this is one of those last, like, true marriages of like art, like artist who is perfectly suited to the material to come in and go, I know how to deploy Downey in such a fun way. I know how to have the right actors who are sitting in the background to do this stuff. And it just, for me, it just succeeds and succeeds and succeeds in just such an unbelievable way that, like, every time I watch it now, I'm like, God, we missed it. We missed something here.
Yeah, and it's brisk as, I mean, it clips along as well. Like, you never find yourself in those, any major lulls. Like, it remembers to be the cheeseburger that it needs to be as well.
Yes, it does.
I do love the kid as well when he's about to drive off and he's like, but I'm cold. And he goes, yeah, I know you're cold. How? Because we're connected.
It's
and even stuff like the watch, like the Dora the Explorer, like when the guy breaks the watch, he's like, that wasn't mine. That was my princess. That belonged to my princess.
I got it. Full props to those bodyguards. That whole scene. Obviously, I think the ponytail guy has been in a few films. Actually, I think he plays that sort of role.
I've got to find that ponytail guy. Ponytail guy from Iron Man 3.
Yeah, you could see him standing on the docks waiting for the shipment of cocaine to come in, at the handover at the warehouse of the cocaine.
His name's Mark Cuba, and his name is. Yeah. Ponytail Express is actually his name.
Nice.
And Mark Cooper has been in. Oh my god, this is so great! I'm gonna check it out. So he's a stuntie. He's a famous stuntie. In fact, he worked on Mandalorian. It's got him as a stuntie in The Mandalorian, and did a whole bunch of stunts for like Captain Marvel. And he's just fantastic. Fantastic as a stuntie in like so many movies for like decades and decades. And as an actor, he's been like a guard, a thug. I'm reading out his character names. Guard, thug, man outside bar, bodyguard, man in diner. Like, that's who he is, Ponytail Express.
That's the one thing I remember coming from two into this was Favreau looking like he was not as, like, he was having a bit more fun as Happy.
Yeah, because he wasn't like directing and having the burden of this whole freaking franchise on his shoulders. Because
he was doing
time.
More action. Remember, he did like the Black Widow action sequence in the first one, in the second one, where they're in like the boxing ring together. Then at the end, they're storming whatever the fucking compound is they're storming. It's been a long time since I've seen it. But I remember him coming on screen and this just going, oh, he looks like he's just hanging out with his buds.
Yes.
Like the stuff with the badges is cool. The Downton Abbey.
The badges, Downton Abbey, he rules. The Downton Abbey touch is so fantastic.
The look he gives the nurse to all of the, when he's all burned up.
The makeup and stuff,
The nurse, just like, the closest he's ever been to a woman in his life. And they both want to watch Downton Abbey together. I was like, well done, Fab. You've solved it.
Yeah, that was when you believed that Fav could hook up with like a nice looking nurse as opposed to like hooking up with Aunt May, which you're like, dude, you are punching, bro. Yeah.
No, that's the only thing that's broken my sense of disbelief.
it's not all the technology. It's not that with sunglasses you can call down the apocalypse. It's that he could hook up with Aunt May.
Yeah, especially in those jeans. I like this. I think it's still top tier. I think it's towards the upper tier MCU. I think it's stood the test of time.
This period where you had like this and then I think it was Guardians 1 and Captain America Winter Soldier the next year.
Yeah.
It was like, whoa.
Strong period.
Yeah.
Because
how
long, when did Ant-Man, I was going to.
Ant-Man was in this phase. Ant-Man was in this
phase. Yeah, the end of this phase, yeah.
Yeah.
Because Ant-Man was still fun as well. Like, Ant-Man, those, they all still work. Like, when, you know, having Douglas in there, like...
When Michael Peña tells that story in Ant-Man, that might be one of the best sequences in the whole series.
Oh, the drunk history story, like... Yeah, the drunk history story. Which one, the one in the van or the drunk, like, yeah. Because, I mean, that's the other thing. All I still remember was that around this time... Had the Edgar Wright stuff started by this? It was probably after the
That would have been that in terms of actually going into production. Yeah, it was around this time. It was after the release of this, but because, before Ant-Man was 2015, so that would have been production 2014.
They were starting to be. It's sort of the growing pains that Star Wars has gone through of losing creatives. Marvel was starting to like they lost someone off for the Dark World late, didn't they lose?
Yeah.
Patty Jenkins. And then there was another female director came in for that. And then they had a couple others that like the Edgar Wright was probably one of the bigger.
Did they jump to Nikki Caro, Garth? Was that who it was? I feel like it was Patty Jenkins.
It was Michelle McLaren, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, yes, it was McLaren. Yes, yeah.
Nikki Caro did. Didn't she just do... No, I thought she's got something out now, doesn't she? Didn't Nikki Caro do...
Yeah, she's got that JLo movie, yeah.
And she did Mulan as well.
Yeah, so there's a few that like this time they had a couple of people fall out, and then I feel like they found when the Russos came in and did that second Cat movie, it was like
they did
Winter Soldier.
Yeah, but they also did Civil War as well.
Yeah, and then they came in and they were like, these are the guys.
And then they sort of built it over those next. They became a couple of tent poles that they built everything from, which it still works. I mean. They haven't made anything of note since.
Well, they might just fund the first AI movie studio because, you know, that's...
Yeah.
We'll just see what happens with the Russos. They just feel like memes. Every time that Garth, who I know is actually a legit newsman, writes a story about the Russos...
Cover their stuff. Oh,
yeah, I read it and I'm like, is Garth finally cracked? Like, has he actually cracked and just like gone and started turning the side into the onion? Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
When the Russos have a new news story, it's like, I don't know, man.
Yeah. There are times.
Look, Shane Black, though, talking of Iron Man 3, Shane Black does such a good job on this movie. And this is the time where, you know, speaking for, you know, Downey's, it's almost like Shane Black did the huge favor for Downey to get him into Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. That was his like true reemergence back on the scene after a whole bunch of troubles. He gets himself out of director jail with Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, comes in and does Iron Man 3. And then it's just like, okay, cool. He can make some more movies. He makes The Nice Guys a couple of years later, which again, horrendously underrated. And if we're still doing decade project episodes, you'll definitely hear that in a couple of years' time. I'll be doing an episode on The Nice Guys because it absolutely deserves it. It's a sensational movie and we've potted about it before. But then he kind of does The Predator, which by all accounts, again,
but that was mired. That was mired in production hell as well.
Yeah, like, they redid a whole bunch of that movie. That was a lot of problems.
I think he got left holding the bag.
Is there a release the Predator cut, Garth? Do we know if there's a
lot of it happened sort of enough that it happened early on, and then there was, a lot of it's still unfinished. It's that kind of thing where you need a Zack Snyder, a couple of million. Bucks to really sort of finish it.
Couple, wasn't it 40 in the end? They gave him for Justice League. But
Justice League was a lot more than that.
Oh wow,
Snyder's one cost about $70 million, I think, to finish.
So he currently has only he's got three things or two things that are in pre-production, Lethal Weapon 5, which is apparently written by Shane Black and Richard Wenk and is going to be directed by Mel Gibson. That is there's no
at this, at this stage, I'm playing Riggs. All right. That's how long that's been around.
Oh, man. And then there's Doc Savage, which is an independent comic.
Oh, that's been around. He's been trying to do that for 15 years.
Yeah. Keep saying that that's with Dwayne Johnson, but, you know, like, I don't know. We'll see. That's a dumb piece of casting if ever I've heard it. And then there's another one here that says he's in pre-production of something called Play Dirty, which looks like, is that a Parker novel?
Oh, one of those ones, yeah.
Well, it says the characters
Aguilera biopic.
No, it says dirty. And no, but it's apparently starring Downey. So, you know, that there's okay. there's a Shane Black one that's on the horizon. So it's funny. This man has gone through from being the like rock star screenwriter, having an 87 to pretty much, you know, 87 to kind of 92-3. Lethal Weapons, Monster Squad, Last Boy Scout, and then he kind of has a little gap after The Last Action Hero because that movie tanked so bad, even though it's pretty fun. And then Long Kiss Goodnight, Lethal Weapon 4, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. But for the longest time, he's just kind of like been on the outs.
Yeah. I wonder how much he does that we don't know, if he does a lot of like
the polishing. That happens a lot. That does happen on a lot of them.
A lot of mercenaries.
That's what's interesting listening to that Macquarie stuff. When you're like, oh, then we just like, oh, yeah, we talked to Macquarie about this for an afternoon and he came in and took a pass at this massive title, couldn't break it, moved on, came in, did like, there'd be a lot of that. But, and these guys probably don't need to. You have a run like that in the 80s, it would have been some decent coin.
But yeah, it was like four
or five. I'll always see a Shane Black film, like whatever it is. It might be this, it might be Predators. You know, like I say, I think I'm lower on Kiss Kiss Bang Bang than most, but I think it's that chemistry.
I adore it between
him and Val is amazing.
Yeah.
Because you think, like, as we're wrapping up, like, you think the visual look of this is very sort of like a television, like, it's very televisual. There's not a lot of, like, there's not a lot of striking shots.
Until that one absolutely out of this world plane sequence. It is quite modest.
Yeah. But that as an action set piece. But he's most of like his camera is pretty straightforward. Like,
yeah, he doesn't muck around.
That's true.
It's very workmanlike. It gives people places to cook.
80s.
We're going to do Prisoners next, and we've got a lot more visuals and stuff to talk about there.
But no, it's still a big thumbs up even 10 years later for me on Iron Man 3.
Yeah, I think when I think back now, I'm like, there was a time, and it's, you know, in the past, you're like, oh, I wish they were still like this, but I don't care anymore. Like, I'm so glad that this exists. I can go back and really enjoy it and be like, this was a time when this entire franchise felt like it had possibility and felt like it had fun and felt like it had a wider appeal. And it's slowly ground itself into this pocket that there's this very rabid fan, very rabid $200 to $500 million American fandom that will just go out and see this movie 27 times. And then there's the rest of us who go out and watch it. And like, depending on whether it's actually good, we'll like tip it over into the high close to a Billy mark or just kind of go, I'll wait until it pops on my Disney Plus in 15 minutes. Like, that's basically the quandary that they put themselves in, but it actually made me miss like the event. It made me think of like seeing that first Iron Man 3 trailer and knowing that Shane Black was going to be directing it and then seeing him carry the suit. And it's like, oh my God, like, this is so sick. Like, it made me like remember that very fondly. It made me remember being a guy who could have his 30th birthday and dress as Iron Man and go on a pub crawl. Maybe remember that.
I vaguely remember running into you guys at the bank.
By that stage, I don't know if I ever told this story on a podcast, but I think it's a good way to end. I know how good this movie is because it came out in
2013.
2013, right? So it's 10 years ago. These movies were so huge that at my 30th, which is now 8 years ago, so like 2015, I dressed as Iron Man in like a pretty cool dress-up suit. And I walked into the Bank Hotel in Newtown in Sydney, and people cheered and came over and took my mask off and put it on their heads and took selfies with it and were going freaking crazy. Like
they were cheering for Garth Star-Lord.
Yeah, they did that too. I mean, that was a great Star-Lord outfit. It was
really cool. I remember we had the bartender and everything, and like, here we go. Oh, yeah, you're Iron Man. Who the fuck are you?
I'm like, that's Star-Lord, bro. And he's like, okay, have a shot. Great times. Show some respect on Star-Lord's name. Very fun. But no, this movie just rocks and it bites, and it's so fun to see a filmmaker play in the sandbox and be allowed to play in it. You know, so I think, you know, Stu and I know talk quite a bit about Rogue One, which has grown on me tremendously. And in the wake of Andor, has grown on me probably even more. And it's like, oh, remember when they used to just let someone have it go in the sandbox and not have to worry about the stock of the company being in jeopardy, you know, they just gave them a crack. And, you know, like I really miss that. And I think if there's anything over the last 10 years, it's that we don't see it anymore. But lads, thank you so much for doing the first of two. So let's put a stamp on Iron Man 3. Any final thoughts, Garth, before we jump off, or Stu?
No, I'm good.
No, it's pretty good. It's one of those films that's just, I to this day, I get a lot of flack for, you know, really loving it. It's one of the ones that there's some people that just, no matter how much time has passed, they just can't get past certain things in this movie. I'm not sure why, but that's the
Look, that's their problem. I'm going to say it right now. If you don't like this one, I don't understand. I don't know what more you want out of these damn movies. Like as an adult, as an adult person.
Yeah. I mean, for the question that I shouldn't be asking anyway, you know, like as a 47-year-old man, what do you want from the movie designed for 12-year-olds?
Yeah. So I would just say it absolutely rules. And it showed that there was an ability to kind of really, truly hit a four quadrant appeal. And I miss it. I miss enjoying a Marvel movie coming out like it was an event. I miss it.
Yeah.
I miss it. Yeah. Well, that's enough, lads. Thank you so much. Obviously, you can find Garth at darkhorizons.com or at Dark Horizons on the Twitter sphere. You can find all of his stuff there. And, you know, you'll often see both Stu and I interacting. You can find Stu at Twitter at Stu_watches. Or if you just go into, usually it's actually put better as an interface like Spotify. You can go into your show and you can search episodes. He's on about 30 One Heat Minute Productions episodes. He's on about 10 Patreon episodes. You'll find him all over the place. I mean, I know on other shows, they've got like, he's, you know, people will say he's like an MVP, he's an all-star, he's this, he's just part of the furniture on One Heat Minute Productions. He's everywhere, he's all over. He's an essential member, and it's so nice to have him back to talk about this as well. Both of you lads, this is always fun when we're together.
Pleasure.
Always. And it feels like such a 20th century movie. It feels like something David Lean would have done or tried to do when he still had that kind of currency. And even then, he might not have succeeded.
It's incredible because, like, if you don't have time to watch all five seasons of Lost, you can just watch Fearless.
Not a week goes by that I don't think of the ending of Gallipoli. It's left a mark. A Year of Living Dangerously. You know, and then something like Last Wave, even, that's so deeply embedded with the land and the story of the land, the story of place. You know, I don't know that I'd seen very many movies at that point in my life that had such a down ending, and they had such a, you know, sort of strong sense of folklore attached to it as that. And something always so poetic and lyrical about Peter Weir's work.
Gallipoli was the first movie that ever traumatized me, and I don't think I ever really recovered from it. And I'm still upset that they played it in school. Like, I don't think it's actually possible to make an... They say it's not possible to make an anti-war movie, but I think Peter Weir pulled it off.
Yes.
Because no one watches that movie then thinks, I want to go to war.
Peter Weir is the greatest director that Australia has ever produced. Like, bar none, hands down. Like, no one else has even... in the room.
I think you have covered some really titanic filmmakers and some really titanic films so far, but I truly think what makes Peter Weir special and what makes you doing this one special is we don't talk about Peter Weir that way, and we should. Peter Weir is one of those guys who I don't get why he isn't a bigger name, why he isn't more in that rarefied air,
yes.
Because I think film for film, he's one of our very best filmmakers. He has brought his A game repeatedly to many properties. There are films of his that I hold very dear. Fearless, The Mosquito Coast. I will fight somebody if they talk bad about The Mosquito Coast. It's, man, I love that movie. But in general, I just think he is a special filmmaker, a smart, lyrical, hallucinatory filmmaker. He's a very dreamy filmmaker, and I don't think he gets his due.
You know, Master and Commander is one of my all-time favorite movies. It's easily one of the best movies of the last 20 years. It's, it's a grand scale. There's a historical backdrop to it. But at the same time, there's such an intimacy in the relationships.
Which I think is not just a great film and one of the last great epics in the truest sense. I think is actually kind of a sliding doors change point moment in cinema history. I think 2003, when that comes along, and it is an old-fashioned, we don't make them like that anymore type film. I think if Master and Commander spawns a franchise at that point, the entire cinema landscape globally is completely different.
That's the movie that I wanted to see 10 of those, and yeah, I know they're big fans of Fast and Furious and everything, and God bless you, but Master and Commander should have been.
It's one of those things, again, I'm not a seafaring man, sir. But there is a sense of authenticity. There's a sense of really watching a genuine dedication to recreating history unfold on a big screen in front of you that can't help but inspire just genuine admiration and awe.
If you're going to pick a film where he really brings every one of his skills to the table, it's Master and Commander. I think you picked the right one, man.
Yeah, very excited to see what you pull out of this, Blake.
That's right. Our next series is Peter Weir and Russell Crowe's Master and Commander. The series is called Podcaster and Commander.